This is Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield.
Thanks for joining me for another episode. Before we get into today's program, I just wanted to mention that Theory of Change is part of the Flux Media Network, so go to flux.community for more podcasts and articles about politics, religion, media, and society, and how they all intersect and influence each other. And if you like this program, you can go to theoryofchange.show and get the full archives with the video, audio, and transcript of every episode. And if you are a paid subscribing member, thank you very much for your support. You are making this possible. If you can't afford to subscribe right now by a paid subscription, we have free subscriptions as well. And you can also do that on either Substack or Patreon. The links are at theoryofchange.show. And so you can go to that, theoryofchange.show. And so with that little plug out of the way, let us get into today's program. Jewish fascism. It's a term that seems cruelly oxymoronic. A mockery of the memories of millions of people who were slaughtered by Adolf Hitler. And yet, Jewish fascism is real. It is a thing that exists. And it is an incredibly strange and hateful thing. But what does Jewish fascism look like? And why is it a thing? Joining me today to talk about them is Ben Lorber. He is a senior research analyst at Political Research Associates, a progressive organization that studies right-wing extremism. Welcome to Theory of Change, Ben.
Thanks, Matthew. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So I did want to mention to the audience that you have recently written an article over at Religion Dispatches about the phenomenon of Jewish fascism. So if anybody wants to dig in even further than what we're going to do in this episode, I definitely recommend people check that out. So I guess this is a very strange topic, I think, to a lot of people, as I said in the introduction. So let's maybe first get started on who are these people and what are they doing?
Yeah, well, I think when you have a term like Jewish fascism, you be talking about a wide range of phenomena. As I'm sure we all know, there's a really horrific war, an assault being committed by the far-right Israeli government on Gaza right now. And that's certainly one locus of it, right? The extreme right in Israel, largely, though not exclusively, a religious Zionist movement, has been growing for decades and has been allying itself with all kinds of European ethno-nationalist leaders. And then you also have a minority of the American Jewish community and the global diaspora Jewish community that's also allying itself with the far right around issues ranging from immigration to Black Lives Matter to support for Israel to the separation of church and state, right? The global Jewish far right really is very, very similar to other far right movements.
Yeah, that's right. And in regards specifically to the idea of the fascists that we're talking about here, a lot of them are directly connected to the Israeli far right. And they are doing a lot of memes and things like that in reference to killing Palestinians and that sort of thing. And it's one of the things that you talk about in the article is that these Jewish fascists are trying to make connections to other far right-wing extremist groups, so including people who are explicitly anti-Semitic, including people who are jihadists or Christian supremacists.
Yeah. I mean, online, something that myself and other researchers have seen since October 7th that I wrote about in my Religion Dispatches article is really a growth in these alt-right meme accounts that are Jewish. They're run by Jews. Obviously, it's possible that they're anonymous, so they could be lying that they're Jewish, but it's pretty clear that they have a deep familiarity in Jewish religious iconography in Israeli history and Jewish identity. Like much of the global far right, they're championing themes of hyper-masculinity. They're championing vitriolic racism, both toward Palestinians and toward like Arabs and Muslims more broadly. Like much of the far right, they're virulently opposed to the ceasefire demonstrations that have been very present across the U.S. and many Western countries in recent months. They see these ceasefire demonstrations through racist terms, right? They see predominantly Arab and Muslim and Palestinian-led demonstrations as a sign of what, you know, they call the Great Replacement, right? What they view as like the dangerous brown hordes who they see as threatening, you know, the stability of white Western Christian civilization, or as they'll call it, Judeo-Christian civilization. And so there are these meme accounts who are championing this, but this is also the kind of rhetoric that you hear from Israeli far-right leaders and that we've been hearing for a long time, right? Folks like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or Naftali Bennett or Bezalel Smotrich, Israeli far-right leaders, they always depict Israel as the kind of frontline, you know, defender of Judeo-Christian civilization or the West against the Islamic East, right? In a kind of clash of civilizations. You hear this from President Trump. You also hear former President Trump, I should say. Hopefully he'll remain that way. You also hear this in many form from political leaders across the aisle in the U.S. So we're really at a dangerous moment where the Israeli right is really a core part of the global ethno-nationalist far right, in some ways leading the way. And this is a very dangerous moment for progressive Jews like myself, who really have a very different vision of Jewish identity and Jewish safety and all those things.
Yeah, that's right. And as you noted, there is a broad cross-section of many of these individuals seem to be people with extreme fundamentalist opinions, and they are correct to be able to cite specific verses in specific books of the Bible to support their ideas. But we do have to make clear that the Jewish tradition and Judaism itself has many conflicting pieces in the Bible. We don't even know how many authors the Bible has technically, but nonetheless, it is the case that many more traditionalist Jewish theologians are, they're into this idea of authoritarianism. They're into the idea that truth comes from God and they control what God says. That's a very convenient narrative. And it's one that runs consistently in a lot of religions as well. And it's one of the threads that you do see quite a bit in these individuals that you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that's very much in common with, you know, the Christian nationalist far right, the Jewish nationalist far right, also the Muslim nationalist far right, is they claim, and not to mention like Hindu nationalists in India, right? Really all religious ethno-nationalism, they claim to hearken back to some kind of primordial truth that they find in their religious scriptures, right? They claim that they're the inheritors of an unbroken tradition stretching back into the very foundations of their religion. But I think that's really misleading, right? These are very modern movements, right? They were built, the Christian right in the U.S. was built by ideologues in the 70s and the 80s. The Jewish nationalist right in Israel really strengthened and got kicked off post-1967, post the Six-Day War. We see similar things with the global Muslim far right. These are obviously all very complicated phenomena. But, you know, they're modern, you know, phenomena, and these people don't have a monopoly on what religious, you know, texts mean. They don't have a monopoly on religious truth. I mean, there are inspiring movements within Judaism and Christianity and Islam that draw very different conclusions from our texts. And I think it's always a danger that nationalists and fundamentalists will cherry pick in various religious traditions to kind of bolster their political goals. And it's really important to remember that there's a great diversity of religious opinions and traditions out there.
So we've got on the screen your Religion Dispatches article. And so for people who are listening, you've got some of the memes that they are using. And one of them is a meme of a muscular looking Jewish man who looks like a bodybuilder in front of some women who seem to be admiring him quite a bit, and they are apparently Romans based on the architecture behind them. And it's this idea of trying to integrate within the other nationalisms that we're talking about, as you were saying. And one of them, as people can, let me just scroll down a little bit further here, that, you know, one of the memes here, I'll describe the first one, and then you can describe the second one. So we've got a Confederate soldier depicted on the left side in front of a Confederate battle flag, And then we have a somebody who appears to be some sort of Israeli soldier with a Israel flag in the background behind him. Now, what's the image below that, the meme that that's depicted there?
Yeah, the image below is in many ways even more shocking. It shows a Jewish man with, and you can't really see it so well with the way that it's cut off, but he has like a Nazi yellow star on him, really an embrace with a white power activist. And he has a pin on his chest that says white pride worldwide. And so the idea, which is like really counterintuitive, right? Because white nationalists are deeply anti-Semitic. They have anti-Semitic conspiracy theories at the core of their ideology, right? Their central belief is that a Jewish cabal has taken control of immigration, of government, of media, in order to wage war against white people. So, but in the eyes of the Jewish far right, this is an alliance they would like to see, right? They'd like to position the Jewish community within the broader far right. They see common enemies, right? They see, look, the state of Israel is under attack in their view from brown people, essentially, and white people in the U.S. are under attack in their view from brown people. So let's get together and let's build a new traditionalist, nationalist kind of vanguard alliance to save the West. And that is really like a mockery of thousands of years of Jewish history, where it very much has been, European Christian civilization that oppressed Jews for thousands of years. So to see it reversed now in this kind of very, very visible way is quite disturbing.
Yeah, it is. And it should be noted that these outreach efforts, while they are rejected by many traditional white nationalist Christian supremacist types, some of them have been reciprocating. And one of them in particular is a guy named Jared Taylor, who has been running a magazine and website for many decades called American Renaissance. And he is very friendly explicitly to Jews who want to come and be a member of his organization. And he's had many Jewish people speak at his conferences over the years. And then it's also the case that Richard Spencer, the infamous white nationalist activist, had also said for a number of years, and he's perhaps changed his public stated views recently, but for the longest time, he said that Israel was a model for what he was trying to do in the United States. So, I mean, how serious do you think the white nationalist community, if you will, is responding to these overtures by Jewish far-right people?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different factors at play. When we say the white nationalist in a community, that might mean very many different things, right? There are neo-Nazis on the internet who never want to ally with any Jewish people. They see Jews as the prime enemy. And many of the neo-Nazis or other white supremacist groups like the America First Groyper movement, they're actually very, very anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, but not out of any progressive politics or any real sympathy with Palestinians. It's really like a feature of their anti-Semitism. But for others, right, like you mentioned, like Jared Taylor and the MAGA movement more broadly, if you want to consider the MAGA movement kind of part of white nationalism, they're very welcoming to Jews, right? I mean, the MAGA movement has always tried to recruit different minorities into its coalition, right? At its core, the base is white evangelicals, and it very much, you know, trades on white grievance and on Christian nationalism. But they've also been very adept at outreach to African-American communities or to Latinx communities or to Jewish communities. And of course, many Jews in America are also white, but there are also many Jews of color and Jews who are part of these other groups as well. But the global far right has always had multiracial components and multi-religious components. So I think it's important to see these overtures between Jewish nationalists and other varieties of nationalists as part of this, you know, diverse global nationalist coalition that has room for Hindu nationalists. It has room for some conservative Muslims. It has room for folks like Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro, right? It's a diverse movement. And I think more attention has to be paid to the subtle and clever ways that the MAGA movement tries to make room for religious and racial minorities.
Yeah, No, it is very important. But it's also worth noting that the way that they make this room, it is for people who know their place. That, you know, so Israel is the place where Jews need to be, and India is the place where Hindus need to be. But within those confines of those states, they should have untrammeled power and not have to have any regard for human rights or minority rights of any kind. And then, of course, you see that as well with far-right Black politicians and activists like Candace Owens or many of these up-and-coming podcasters out there as well that are Black far-right individuals. And of course, it's worth noting that Enrique Tarrio, the former head of the Proud Boys, is a Black Hispanic man and uses that as a way to sort of shield his organization from accusations of racism.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And there's another movement that's worth mentioning here, the National Conservatives, National Conservative Movement. They hold conferences every year in national conservatism. They're primarily based in the U.S., but they've also held conferences all across the West. And they are hardline Christian nationalists, right? They think the U.S. should become a Christian nation with a fundamentalist interpretation of Christianity, right? Encoded in our laws and our policies and the identity of this country. But ironically enough, national conservatism was started by an Israeli Jewish philosopher named Yoram Hazony. And there are many traditionalist Jews in that coalition. And I've talked to some of them. Like, I went to the National Conservatism Conference in 2022 in Florida, and I talked to many right-wing Jews at that conference who said openly, we want to live in a Christian nation. We don't see it as a threat to us if the dominant character of the United States is no longer pluralistic and there's no longer a separation of church and state, but if fundamentalist Christianity is enshrined as the law and the culture of the land. And some even said to me, I'd rather my kids be educated in a Christian private school than in a secular public school, because at least in a Christian private school, they won't be exposed to liberalism or to transgender rights or to racial justice movements. So, and that was really shocking to me as someone, I mean, Christians have been trying to convert Jews and trying to convert everyone else for a really long time. So it's kind of like, would you really want your own child to go to a Christian private school for 8 hours every day? And these people were like, yes, because to them, the greater enemy is the left. I thought that was a really disturbing but fascinating look into their view.
Yeah, and one person who I think who really kind of popularized that opinion among American Jews is Dennis Prager, who is a radio host with a Christian supremacist company named Salem Media. And his interpretations of Judaism are, I mean, he actually has said explicitly, the role of Judaism now in the 21st century is to convert people to Christianity. Because we have to preserve the Abrahamic values. And so since Judaism is not evangelical, well, then I guess making people be Christians and helping Christians sign people up, that's what Jews should do. And I think to some degree, people who are, let's say, more devoutly and more traditionally Jewish, they might have a general affinity for somebody like Dennis Prager, but not understand what he's actually trying to do to Judaism, which is destroy it.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating because people talk a lot on the right about a Judeo-Christian West, right? As if there's this unbroken continuity in the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament together really formed the bedrock of whatever we're calling Western civilization. And that's kind of an unbroken 2,000-year-old tradition. But really, like I was saying before, the whole idea of a Judeo-Christian West is also a very recent, very modern invention. It was initially formed right after World War II, after the Holocaust, as a way to kind of make atonement for what Europe as a whole, and Germany in particular, had just done to the Jews, and to say, hey, now the main enemy is communism, right? So we are the Judeo-Christian West, and our enemy is communism in the East. And then once the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, the enemy became Islamic fundamentalism, right? So Judeo-Christian has always really functioned more to signify who we aren't rather than who we are. And yeah, I mean, I think it's very disturbing, especially in a given that Christian nationalists, ultimately, even though Orthodox and right-wing Jews are in their coalition, the laws they want to make the laws of the land are disastrous for religious Jews as well. Religious Jewish law is not so anti-abortion as Christian nationalism is, right? Halacha, or traditional Jewish law, tends to place a lot more priority on the health and the safety of the birthing parent, right? That's just one example of how if the Christian nationalist vision really becomes a law of the land, you know, even Orthodox Jews are going to be unable to fully fulfill their own teaching. So it's really mind-boggling how this coalition has come to pass. And you know, it's a minority of American Jews who feel this way, right? Over 75% of American Jews have voted for Democrats, broadly adhere to liberal values. It's always been a minority that's willing to cast its lot with the Christian right, but it's a very, very vocal minority and a very well-funded minority. So they've been able to capture a lot of the national conversation.
Yeah. Well, and in addition to Dennis Prager, I think there are the two other most prominent far-right Jews in the United States are probably a guy who goes by the name of Bronze Age Pervert, And then also Ben Shapiro, the YouTuber and columnist. So let's first talk about Bronze Age Pervert. Why are we even having to talk about someone with such a ridiculous pseudonym? And it should be noted he's known as we know who this guy is. So, but who is he? Who is he? And how popular is he?
Yeah, I mean it's interesting. You know, I'm not sure Bronze Age Pervert. I mean, he sometimes identifies as Jewish. I think it was initially other people on the radical right who outed him as having some Jewish ancestry as a way to discredit him, like in their anti-Semitic worldview, right? But he, I think it's fascinating that he is at least partially Jewish because he is a fascist. He's part of the Manosphere. He advocates for a really triumphalist, chauvinist masculinity, virulent hatred of basically every other imaginable under the sun. He explicitly calls for the rebirth of a kind of like warrior state in the West. He's just basically as hardline fascist as you can get, but he's been influential. His book, Bronze Age Mindset, which basically counsels men to kind of embody like a warrior ethos. It was read by members of the first Trump administration. It's read by a lot of especially the young, more Gen Z millennial far-right activists who are shaping the policy of future conservative administrations. And he has a big online cult following. And yeah, a lot of these Jewish fascists who I mentioned in my article are sympathetic to Bronze Age Pervert. And as the memes that you were showing, you know, demonstrated, they also believe in this kind of like ultra-masculinist, ultra-misogynist warrior mentality that they imagine will lead to the rebirth of the Jewish nation or whatever. And there's a lot to be said about the crisis of masculinity that's, you know, been commented on a lot in our discourse that could lead a lot of men to think that by going to the gym a lot and by being macho assholes and by being completely chauvinist, they will kind of redeem themselves and redeem their people. There's a lot to be said there, but yeah, he is a very disturbing far-right thought leader.
Yeah. And he's constantly in tension also, it should be said, with as you kind of alluded to earlier, with these avowedly anti-Semitic individuals like Nick Fuentes and some of the other ones that basically they're having a really prolonged dispute of how much anti-Semitism is the right amount, because it is also the case that Bronze Age Pervert, and we should, how do you pronounce his name? Do you know how to pronounce his name?
I think it's Kostin Alamariu, but I could be awesome mispronouncing it. Maybe.
Okay.
I don't really know.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's also not explicitly philo-Semitic either, and that's is another commonality that he has with some of these other online Jewish fascists. And so he trots that out every so often as a way of trying to push back against the Fuentes types to say, no, look, I really do hate some Jews, I promise. They're not all good. Like that's the precarity that all of these people have, is that, to what you were saying earlier, that they're trying to carve out a space for themselves among people who hate Jews, and they can't see or don't seem to be perturbed by that precarity.
Yeah. I mean, one way they do it is by saying, like, look, we agree with white nationalists like Nick Fuentes that liberal progressive Jews are a big enemy and a big threat, right? They say we also are deeply opposed to liberal Jews who have been involved in labor unions or who have been involved in movements like Black Lives Matter, right? But we do like the strong, muscular, militant, chauvinist Israeli leaders who are currently proving their manhood by pummeling Gaza to pieces, right? And so they try to say, look, these are the good Jews. The Israelis are sometimes the ultra-Orthodox Jews in America who are aligned with the Christian right. But these are the bad Jews, right? The globalists, the cultural Marxists. And so they try to do that. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I should say that Israeli leaders themselves also try to play into this dichotomy, right? You have Israeli leaders like Benjamin Netanyahu who scapegoats George Soros as the mastermind behind African refugees and immigrants in Israel, who he's worried are destroying the Jewish majority, right? So it's really an identical anti-Soros scapegoating that's deeply anti-Semitic that you also see from Viktor Orban in Hungary or Donald Trump in the US, right? So Bibi Netanyahu is doing his own, like, right, we are the good Israelis who are going to help lead this global nationalist coalition, but George Soros or liberal Jews in the US, they are the bad Jews, right? So that's one way they try to integrate themselves in the global far right.
Yeah. And they also try to play into racism as well as to use as a shield against people who are anti-Semitic. And in fact, that is one of the key complaints that they have, I think, have been somewhat effective against Nick Fuentes, to say that, well, Nick Fuentes is not racist enough. He doesn't hate Black people the way that we do. And he doesn't regard them as genetically inferior and deserving to be cast out. And it's effective to some degree, and that's part of why I think that he hates Bronze Age perverts so much, for that reason. So it's worth noting, I think, also.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And it should be said that really there's a great divide right now in the global Jewish community. I mean, I've been an advocate for Palestinian rights with groups, the Jewish Voice for Peace, for almost a decade now, and progressive Jews in the U.S. and around the world, including in Israel, have long fought for civil rights. And I believe we are still the majority of the global Jewish community. But I think you see this across many different faith communities, right? There's a reckoning happening within many Christian communities in the U.S. and many denominations around, like, well, what direction are we going to take? Are we going to side with Christian supremacy and nationalism, or are we going to fight for equal rights? And I think that same argument is playing out in American Jewish communities around the war in Gaza and in the global Jewish community.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And then, so I mentioned earlier, the other most prominent far right Jew in America is Ben Shapiro. And I it's regrettable, I think, that a lot of people do not know that Ben Shapiro is anti-Semitic, severely so, against people that he considers to be bad Jews. And we'll talk about that concept later, the idea of the bad Jew, further. But he explicitly showed where his racism and his anti-Semitic ideas come in a 2014 appearance that he made on a far-right white nationalist anti-Semitic podcast called Red Ice, which is run by one of the most popular white nationalists in the world, Lana Lakatoff. And he did an interview with her to promote a book that he had written. And he just went on with her at great length.
There are a lot of Jews in Hollywood who feel the they have a perverse leftist view of history pushed by the Soviet Union, that what really destroyed Europe was Christianity. It was not fascism. It was not communism. It was not leftism. It was Christianity. And therefore the cure to intolerance is to bash the hell out of Christianity. And so there's a war. There certainly is a war on Christianity. It's coming from, you know, some people who are secular Jews. It's coming from a lot of leftists. But yeah, I mean, there's no question that evangelical Christians support Israel at a much higher clip and much more substantially than most Jews in America do, because most Jews in America don't care about Judaism.
And then he also went on to complain about putting black characters in films.
I mean, everybody who's bad is by nature a member of the white patriarchy, and everybody who's good is by nature a member of a minority group. This is why you have the stock character who is the wise black friend, right? It's never the wise white friend. Yeah. It's always the wise female friend or the wise gay friend or the wise black friend, because the impression is that the only wise people in our society are members of minorities, which is not to say, of course, that there are not wise black people. There are plenty of them, right? I mean, Thomas Sowell is a very wise black man.
That's great.
But the idea that, you know, every person on television who is wise must be of minority persuasion is really a very subtle war on kind of the white males in our society, which, of course, white males can take, but it does pervert, you know, the American mind as far as how we view certain segments of the population.
Conservatives are always racist, sexist, homophobic. Right now they're pushing this anti-nuclear family, anti-white, anti-Christian. So what is it that they want here?
Well, I mean, what they want is they want to destroy kind of the foundations of American society. And there's no question that this is what they want. I mean, this has been the case for the left since the 1960s. And they're just part of the broader left culture, which suggests that American culture is deeply evil, that the bourgeois are deeply evil.
There's a popular conception that can be very appealing to a lot of Americans who are Christian or maybe who are raised Christian, that if you see a guy with a kippah, a guy who follows Orthodox Judaism, he must be kind of an authentic Jew in a way. So he can't possibly be anti-Semitic. Look at him. He wears his Judaism on his sleeve. No one can confuse him for anything other than a Jewish person. But the reality is that people like Ben Shapiro have kind of imbibed and reproduced a lot of the anti-Semitic tropes that you see in the white nationalist movement, right? Like we were saying, like one of the central beliefs of the far right is that a Jewish cabal, or they might say a globalist or a cultural Marxist cabal, has infiltrated Hollywood media in Black Lives Matter, immigration, as part of some diabolical plot to destroy the white Christian West. And essentially, folks like Ben Shapiro reproduced that ideology. But whereas in a prior century, the Nazis said these folks are all too Jewish or these folks are all Jews, and today folks like Ben Shapiro are saying these folks, these globalists, aren't the real Jews. I'm the real Jew. Real Jews are the ones who follow like one particular interpretation of Judaism. Real Jews are the ones who follow Israeli ultranationalism. And anyone who dissents, like you're saying, is a bad Jew, right? And Donald Trump says this too, right?
I think they hate Israel. And the Democrat Party hates Israel. Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion, they hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves, because Israel will be destroyed.
About a year and a half ago, he had a Truth Social post where he said, evangelicals are some of the best friends Israel's ever had. And American Jews who don't support Israel like the evangelicals do, you better get your act together before it's too late, right? So we really see this ideology really runs right through the heart of the MAGA movement.
It does. And I think perhaps one of the other reasons why Shapiro's racism and anti-Semitism aren't as widely known is that he's like Mitch McConnell in one sense, that he will kind of push back on Trump's rhetoric occasionally, but never actually push back in any meaningful way to say, look, this guy is an anti-Semite, or he is a racist, or whatever, or he's a moron, whatever criticism he might make, which he does occasionally, that never means anything, because he never tells you to actually stop supporting the guy. And Mitch McConnell actually endorsed Donald Trump after being subjected to years of violent lies. Like Trump literally said he has a death wish to oppose me and engaged in all sorts of horrible racism against Mitch McConnell's wife. And none of that mattered because Mitch McConnell ultimately says, well, I support the same shared far-right agenda, and it doesn't matter what kind of abuse that I have to endure in order to see that happen. And Shapiro, you know, same way, I would say.
Yeah. And the irony is that if you roll back the clock to 2015 or 2016, Ben Shapiro and Mitch McConnell and a lot of the other more establishment like Republicans, they weren't necessarily all gung-ho for Trump right from the very, very beginning, right? A lot of the conservative establishment has been afraid of Trump, right? But it's a combination of his own personal charisma, his own bullying. And at the end of the day, these folks have to follow the base, right? Ben Shapiro runs a media empire. He needs views on his platforms. He needs, and the base is with Trump, right? So influencers like Ben Shapiro have to go where the GOP base goes. And so people like Nick Fuentes have long hated Ben Shapiro, not only because he's Jewish, but also because he wasn't always pro-Trump, as far as I understand. But it's been really fascinating to see these guys get in line, right, driven by social media algorithms, driven by the rightward drift that we see all over the conservative movement. I mean, I've been tracking far-right discourse for many years now. And I remember even during the first Trump presidency, hopefully the only Trump presidency, it was very controversial to scapegoat George Soros. Every time Fox News would say, oh, George Soros controls Black Lives Matter, there'd be headlines, there'd be accusations of anti-Semitism. They would even have to retract it and apologize sometimes. But it's become so normalized now that nobody bats an eye. And same thing with the white nationalist great replacement conspiracy theory, right? That an elite cabal is trying to replace, quote unquote, Native Americans with immigrants. That used to be a fringe view. Now it's mainstream. And same with Christian nationalism, right? All these things really over the last few years, right? During the Biden presidency, all of these views that used to be relegated to, you know, to the fringe of right-wing discourse are now enshrined right in the center.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of the center, there is another tactic that is increasingly common among some of these far-right Jewish people, which is to say that the Democrats actually are the extreme and that Joe Biden and or particularly supporters of Palestinian rights, that they are all Nazis and they want to exterminate Jews. And one person in particular, I think, who has really kind of embraced that and been propelled forward very much so by the right-wing Christian supremacist machine is this woman named Batya Ungar Sargon. And she portrayed this idea pretty handily, I think, during an appearance on the Bill Maher show. And I'm going to play a clip here for everybody to hear and watch it.
To you and to most Democrats, Trump is an extremist. But to Trump's supporters, he is a liberal. And they liberal. Like that about him. Yes. So, for example, if you look at his position on abortion, 16 weeks, okay? That used to be like the Democrats' position on abortion.
I agree.
His position on immigration, that was the Democrats' position in the 90s. He's pro-gay and he's courting blacks actively. And all of this is stuff that his supporters love about him.
Right.
So we are in the on the liberal side. The liberal media is misunderstanding how he comes off to his supporters because of how they
see him. I totally agree with that. They don't get him at all.
So, yeah, needless to say, everything that she said there was a lie. Literally everything was a lie. And including her trying to subtly claim that she's a liberal. This is somebody who continuously advocates for Donald Trump and attacks Joe Biden and other people on the center to left continuously. But this is a talking point that really, I mean, it's almost inescapable, especially if you're somebody who listens to anybody remotely connected with the Joe Rogan podcast universe, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's clear from that clip that Batya Ungar Sargon is in Mirror World, right? She's And I was an activist for Palestinian rights. I still am, back in like 2017, 2018, when she was an editor at the Jewish Daily Forward and did have mostly liberal views at the time. And it was really, her far-right transformation really began when she jumped on the bandwagon of this narrative that the left is the biggest anti-Semitic threat to Jews, right? She was one of the main voices out there who was attacking like Linda Sarsour, Ilhan Omar for perceived anti-Semitism. And for a while, you would hear her say, well, both sides have a lot of anti-Semitism, but now I think I haven't listened to her, so I can't say for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if she joined a lot of other commentators in saying that the left is the main anti-Semitic threat. And to me, as a Jew who's been part of leftist and progressive movements for a long time, this is an absurd kind of mirror world discourse. Sure, there's some anti-Semitism in some left-wing movements. There's also some racism and some misogyny, all kinds of oppression, right? It's part of the air we breathe in our deeply flawed society. But people like this miss that anti-Semitism is part of the core driving engine of the global fascist movement of white Christian nationalism, right? There are anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, animating every level of the MAGA movement. And these are the folks who are closest to winning power in our country. Yeah. And by and large,
Oh, and I'm sorry. And also, I mean, Donald Trump, of course, had a very nice chummy dinner with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West. Needless to say, Joe Biden does not have chummy dinners and does not refrain. Like, Donald Trump actually never said, I shouldn't have done that. He is a terrible person who is an anti-Semite, and I condemn anti-Semitism. Donald Trump never said anything remotely similar to that. And that's because he's afraid. He needs the people who have that viewpoint. If he actually cared about anti-Semitism, if Republicans cared about it, they would have forced him to apologize for what he did with hanging out with Fuentes and he didn't.
Yeah. I mean, it was the same. Yeah, no, it was the same during his first presidential campaign when he refused to disavow David Duke. It was the same in 2017 after the Unite the Right rally, right, in Charlottesville, when there were cries of Jews will not replace us. And Donald Trump said there are very fine people on both sides, right? You're totally right. He needs them as part of his base. And there's a lot of folks out there who are really, really overhyping up the problem of anti-Semitism in Palestine solidarity spaces, right? I've been in these spaces. It's not anti-Semitic to call for fundamental change in Israel, right? At the moment of this, what I consider to be a genocidal assault on Gaza, it's not anti-Semitic to call for that to stop. And there are many, many Jews who are a vibrant part of movements for Palestinian, freedom. And I think it's a very dangerous narrative out there that has some appeal for portions of the liberals, right? Some Biden voters, right? There's the front page cover of the Atlantic new issue is basically saying, are Jews safe in America because of these Palestine solidarity protests, right? But this is not where the main threat to Jews is. Some Jews might disagree strongly about some views about the state of Israel. And that's okay. We can disagree. That might feel very uncomfortable, but that's a far cry from the murderous and anti-Semitism on the right. Right? No Palestine solidarity activist has shot up a synagogue. No Palestine solidarity activist is saying Jews are controlling the world. Or very, very few of them. There are a few, unfortunately, but very few. This is a core belief on the right. And we just don't see that on the left. And so it's really important for folks to make these kind of distinctions.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's maybe wrap up by talking about the book that you are working on. And it's very clearly a contrast with the approach that we have been discussing today of far-right Jews claiming that it's better for Jews to take refuge among people who despise them. And your book has a different thesis, right?
Yeah. So my book is forthcoming in June. It's called Safety Through Solidarity, A Radical Guide to Fighting Antisemitism. It's co-authored with Shane Burley, who's a great journalist and author himself. And basically we're saying that the way to fight anti-Semitism today is not to build higher walls, is not to double down on militarism or nationalism, but it's to build solidarity with other oppressed and marginalized groups. It's to join social justice struggles. It's to see the connections that exist between anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant xenophobia and anti-Blackness, anti-LGBTQ bigotry. And it's to build coalitions like we're seeing right now to defend and preserve democracy, to defend the rights of immigrants, to defend the rights of Jewish people to live in a pluralistic republic, to defend Palestinian rights. These are all part of ultimately the same struggle for justice for all. And it can be difficult. As I said, there are real sticking points and real divisions that can exist, right? And no one says it's always easy to build solidarity and build coalitions right between other groups. But at the end of the day, this is our best bet for the long-term safety of the American Jewish community and for Jewish values, for Jewish ethics, right? So for the many, many American Jews and other folks around the world who are horrified at what's going on in Israel right now, who are horrified at what, frankly, the Biden administration is doing to support what's going on in Israel, but who are also horrified by the prospect of a second Trump administration, I think it's really important to try to build these coalitions of solidarity with other groups and to fight for a multiracial democracy where all of us can thrive. It's really the only shot we got.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's definitely and it's an important concept to develop, because the American right, from its very beginnings, the reactionary right in the 1960s, they developed this idea that they call fusionism, which is basically a right-wing version of what you just said. That for them, they wanted everybody in their coalition to understand that they had a shared struggle. So even if you weren't into the idea of opposing communism outside of the United States, and you were more interested in Christian supremacism in the United States, those things actually were related, according to them. And they were right to say that. But people who have a more progressive outlook need to understand that the right wing was correct about that, and that we need to come together and work together and share in people's passions and help elevate voices that maybe you may not fully understand what they're talking about, but understand that a struggle for liberation has to include everybody, no matter who they are and where they might happen to live.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You're right about that. I mean, I think we see a lot that the right for many decades has had a long range view. They're really focused on building the broadest possible coalitions on their side to win, right? They don't want to infight, at least publicly. There's plenty of infighting and divisions. At the end of the day, they don't want to cancel each other. They want to say, join us. There's room for you here. They're constantly looking at groups who have been neglected or despised by the left, and they're saying, come join us, right? This is our home for you. But too often, folks who are progressives tend to be at each other's throats and focusing on our differences rather than what might unite us. And I think it's really important, as you're saying, to build the biggest possible coalitions in our country of people who want to defend and extend our multiracial democracy for it to survive, frankly. And we have to have the kind of like long range view they have. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the reality is the only way to protect democracy is to expand it. Because the people who are working to destroy it, they're coming together. And so we have to do the same. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, Ben, this has been a great discussion. For people who are looking to keep up with you, what places are you on with this handle? Is it, or tell us which one?
Yeah, that's my Twitter handle. That's where I am most of the time. You could also follow me on Instagram. And my organization is at politicalresearch.org. We're publishing a lot of great content all the time, looking at different far-right movements and helping progressives to fight back.
Yeah. And for those who are listening, his handle is Ben Lorber. That's L-O-R-B-E-R 8, number 8. So you can find Ben over there, and encourage everybody to do that and to check out the book when it comes out. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here.
All right, so that is the program for today. I appreciate everybody for joining us for the conversation. And if you want more episodes, you can always go to theoryofchange.show, where you can get the full archives, the video, audio, and transcript. And if you are a paid subscribing member, you have complete access to all the material. Thank you very much for your support. You make this possible. And if you can't afford to do a paid subscription right now, please help spread the word about what we're doing here and let people know what's going on. And doing that, you can do that on Apple Podcasts. Just leave a short little written review. Just one sentence is good enough and 5 stars. That's actually super, super helpful if you can do that. I really would appreciate that. And if you are watching over on YouTube, of course, please do click the like and subscribe button so you can get notified with all the new episodes. And I do invite you to check out Flux.community, which is the network that Theory of Change is part of. You can go there and we have lots of other podcasts and articles and other things, serious and not so serious, about the moment that we are all sharing together and trying to work through. So I appreciate your joining me over there as well. And I'll see you next time.